name is Arianis, and I am the Senior Multifaith Educator at Global Spiritual Life at NYU, and this is Multifaithful, the podcast about religious diversity, multifaith dialogue, and effing the ineffable. In this week's podcast, I am joined by Emma Green, a Senior Associate Editor at The Atlantic who covers politics, policy, and religion. She has been publishing a series of articles recently analyzing how millennials and young people are changing the nature of religion in the United States, which is incredibly important to both our center here at NYU and to, I think, religious people in the United States in general. We get into the different areas, how religion is changing, what are the different impacts that millennials are having on religious groups, and what we may be able to expect in the future. Thanks for listening to another episode of Multifaithful, and out of this week's conversation. I am joined today by Emma Green, a senior associate editor at The Atlantic, and someone whose articles about religion on The Atlantic are definitely a must-read for me. Emma, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
And I'm also joined by one of our top students who's making her first appearance. Madeline, you want to introduce yourself with us?
Sure. Thanks, Ariel. I'm Madeline. I'm a senior at NYU studying sustainable fashion production and design. I'm also a member of the Multifaith Advisory Council and have participated in the Global Spiritual Life Fellowships in the past and awesome events that come out of this office. So, excited to be here.
So, Emma, you are in the middle of writing a series of pieces and putting out about young people choosing their religion. And one of the things I love about your articles is that I feel like often in the news when people cover young people and religion, it's sort of like an older young people, millennials are screwing up religion type of coverage. But you're actually really delving into this notion of young people choosing a religion. So I was wondering if you could maybe explain that a little bit to our listeners and what your reporting has been uncovering for you as you talk to young people about their religious choices.
Absolutely. So one of the stats that is often tossed around about young people and religion is that more people who are millennials, which is a little bit of a made-up term, but more people who are roughly in their 20s and early 30s are religiously disaffiliated, meaning that they don't have a particular church or mosque or synagogue that they go to or a particular faith that they feel like they're part of, than any other generation, either when that generation was in their 20s and 30s or any of the older generations now. So basically, young people today are less religious than any other generation before them in America. You know, this is a little bit of a difficult stat to fully test out when you go back and back and back in history, but one of the things that I find interesting about this is that it's a little bit opaque in the sense that getting to the point of religious affiliation, basically saying, do you have a church or not, doesn't really tell you that much about the types of decisions people are making about how they live their lives, how they spend their time, how they're dating, what their sexuality is, what their morality is. All of that is sort of packed underneath this idea of religious disaffiliation. So I think storytelling is a really interesting way of trying to get at some of that. And one way that we've thought about this is religion today proposes a set of choices. Even if you grow up a certain way, you have to make a choice about whether or not you want to continue in that tradition. Some people find religion as they grow into older life. So when they're getting married and they're having babies, they decide that they want religion as a way of doing that. And then some people also have to face really tough choices about, for example, deciding to stay in a community or leave a community that doesn't really accept the way they are. So with gay people, for example, LGBT people, this has been a big issue over the past several years in particular, is there's been more sort of cultural acceptance of LGBT standards and mores. So there are a lot of different choices, but we felt like this was a great way of trying to get at all of the different ways that choice might play out in a religious context. And there are so, so many different ways that you can take that.
Right. And the part that I think is really interesting is that, you know, when we look at data about religion or we get these figures about how many people are religious, I don't know if people always realize that those questions are just self-identification and often don't ask about practices or beliefs. And so it's really hard to then reverse engineer, like, well, what do people believe and what do people think? And I think as religious communities have become a little bit more fluid and open, those questions have only gotten more complex.
Yeah, I absolutely think that's right, which is there are a certain number of poll questions that are typically rolled out by, you know, even some of the top polling organizations, like Pew is great, and the Public Religion Research Institution, they're great,
yeah.
And they're, you know, staffed by people who know exactly what they're doing. But at the same time, polls have limits, and there are ways that polls can also introduce bias. So, for example, believing that the number of hours you spend in church is a direct proxy for how much religious fervor you have, I think it very clearly sort of biases a certain type of religious experience. Certain racial and ethnic groups have different traditions for the number of hours they spend in church. Different types of religious traditions, like Jews, for example, spend longer in synagogue than maybe some Christians do. But getting inside people's heads, I think, is so difficult, and also where the really interesting part of the conversation starts.
Yeah. And and it makes it even more interesting because I feel like this, the importance of the belief aspect that's hard to capture in the numbers makes this type of conversation like very different than sometimes when we talk about race or even just sexuality on its own. Because in a lot of ways, the labels have a much clearer association with a distinct set of practices or beliefs or like what, how I'm being treated by a system.
Yeah, totally. The reason why religion, I think, too, is such a interesting facet of identity is exactly your point. Some of it is hereditary. So, you know, as much as, for example, in Judaism, where certain denominations believe that Judaism is genetically inherited in a certain way. But, you know, Judaism, for example, also has belief components, and it also has sort of national identity components. And this is why religion is so, so complicated and also really cool to have to sort of pick apart all those different layers.
Right. I feel like, Madeline, that corresponds to your experience, because when we were talking right before we started recording, you were saying how when you came to college, like, you do feel like you made a choice about your religion.
Yeah. In fact, my senior year of high school, watching a Jewish friend convert to Christianity was actually the moment where I started to ask myself, what does it mean that I have been born into the Jewish tradition based on my parents both being Jewish, and do I want to continue to be Jewish? And then in coming to college and having those many different communities and getting a chance to explore for myself, you know, made me then come to the conclusion, oh, I do like the community. I do like what I was born into, but, you know, maybe had I found another tradition that I liked, I do explore all the different other faiths, but find that I still do want to identify with Judaism.
So I think also, you, Emma, you mentioned LGBT. What are some of the other issues or like current event topics that are kind of the nexus point for when people have to choose? Like, what's forcing this push and pull on people? Do you have a sense of what is causing people to either opt in or opt out?
Yeah, so along with LGBT issues, one aspect of this that we have spent a lot of time on with this project and will continue to do so is dating and marriage generally. So the choice about whether even, you know, a person of one Christian denomination wants to marry someone of another Christian denomination, and how they will choose which church to go to and which traditions to incorporate into their children's lives. Whether it's important to you, for example, if you come from a tradition that believes interfaith marriage or marrying outside of your faith is, you know, either excommunicable or at least looked down upon, trying to make that choice and negotiate those boundaries. And family expectations, a lot come with sort of the family structure choices you're going to make about dating and marriage and kids and sex. Another thing that I looked at last week, which I think is going to be more and more relevant, is the idea of religious institutions, which have traditionally been huge organizing points for political activism, no longer having that relationship to politics. So you can see this, for example, with the decline of the religious right as a rallying movement within American politics. I looked at the Black Lives Matter movement in Baltimore and the way that black churches, which have always been sort of the center and heart of civil rights activism, and how black churches are a little bit stepping into the background with this new youth-led movement there. So this idea of politics as maybe a separate sphere or a more separate sphere today from religious institutions and religious thinking. We're also going to have projects coming up on people who don't choose to sort of move away from religion, but rather people who choose to move towards religion, mm-hmm. what those kinds of choices mean. So I think there are all sorts of contexts, and then there are all sorts of directions that also those choices can go. They're not sort of unidirectional in the young people's generation.
So I wanna go actually one by one through a few of those, because you mentioned politics and the Black church, and actually I thought your article on it was fantastic. But before that, you mentioned dating and interfaith relationships, or even relationships between people of the same tradition but just different denominations or groups. So I know from personal experience, from talking to students and from my own life, how questions of dating I feel like play a much larger role in people's religious decisions than I think we often give credit for. Have you noticed that sometimes people feel like ignoring that as a force? Because I just see it so often with students, and how who they're going to date and how they're going to date are such central questions. I think that it like overshadows a lot of the religious choices.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's such a tough question, because for different people, different factors of identity matter, and they also probably matter at different points in their life. So, for example, one thing that you will hear a lot in Judaism is this idea that you can date around non-Jewish, but when you're marrying Jewish. And obviously this is, you know, a caricature of a viewpoint that's only held by a certain group of people, right? And not mm-hmm. all Jews believe that. And, you know, there are other parallels probably in a lot of different faiths. So I would imagine, you know, you could hear a similar type of pity phrase, you know, in Islam or in different parts of Christianity. And I think that's what makes the question so complicated, is people at different points in their lives are probably looking for different things. But I think religion, probably more than just about any other kind of identity factor, really can be a make or break thing in terms of how a relationship can work, because religious institutions have long been sort of the pathway houses through which you pass in your life cycle. So if you're going to get married, where are you going to get married? Mm-hmm. At a church or at a synagogue, or maybe at, you know, city hall in front of a judge. But it really matters whether both of those partners are okay with that. You know, people who, too, are struggling with their sexuality, this is what we were talking about before with LGBT people. I think those choices become even more fraught. We had, for example, a piece about the Mormon church mm-hmm. and people who are gay choosing whether or not they want to try to stay within the church, even though there's a significant chance that when they try to become married and sort of are publicly out within their communities, and especially when they have kids, that they may face excommunication. So I think there's a lot of pressure that religion can put on relationships, and, you know, it's different at different points of life. Maybe kids in college don't care about it as much. Maybe they do. It's a lifestyle thing, but it's also very much about sort of future, looking into the future about where all those life cycle events, marriage, babies, death, how will I deal with that, and what are the institutions that I'm going to look to when those things are happening?
Yeah, I've said this before, but I often wonder if intra-faith dating is sometimes even more complicated than interfaith, because sometimes I see a lot of interfaith relationships where you say, oh, we can celebrate two sets of holidays, or we're going to do double of everything or both of everything. And I think for a lot of people that works really well. But sometimes the intra-faith, or within the same broader group but coming from very different backgrounds, can often be even harder, because then you're not just saying like, oh, I want to celebrate this holiday, and you don't. It's, I want to celebrate this holiday this way, and you want to celebrate this holiday a different way, and now what do we do?
Mm-hmm. And then it turns into like who's right or who's wrong. But in my experience, I think that I've dated people of a different faith, but who are of faith, and have found that actually like made me a lot stronger in my religion, and that we had like very cool conversations together, and that we would like share with each other our various traditions, and then we both had like some kind of belief system. But in dating somebody who was very strongly atheist, I found that I like was very emotionally drained, and that he would always ask me these like certain questions in his like just view. It's almost like he was like challenging me on my religion, and then I would get very defensive about that, and then that was almost much more difficult than dating somebody who was of a faith, but just a different faith.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
So, and then, Emma, we were also talking about kind of the Black Lives Matter movement. And I know this is something that, I talk about a lot on campus, and because the center here is always trying to figure out what our role is within sort of broader social justice conversations. And I think when Americans think of, like, social justice and civil rights, there are so many religious leaders that come to mind immediately. Dr. King, mm-hmm. Malcolm X, people like that. And the current iteration is different in a lot of ways. And I thought your article jumped into a lot of those reasons really well. So I thought maybe you could explain, like, what's the difference now? What's going on now for people?
So the Black Lives Matter movement obviously is a nationwide movement, and it's different in different places. So has had, you know, sort of spark ups in different cities like Ferguson, where there have been real touch off points of violence. And one of those cities is in Baltimore, which is where I centered my reporting and focused my story. There's a really strong local grassroots organizing movement and community within Baltimore. And a lot of that is youth-driven. So people who are as young as 16 and 17 starting their own organizations, and then, you know, sort of a few years older than them, people who are now mentors for those high schoolers who themselves in high school and college have been part of this activist community. What I found to be interesting was talking with some of these young organizers and asking them the way in which their religious life or non-religious life does or does not influence how they think about organizing, and whether or not they turn to the church as sort of a central resource for the work that they're doing. And there was a lot of variety. Some people actively were hostile to the church, so saying with, you know, some degree of fairness that the church historically has been not an incubator of equality and fairness, but rather sort of a perpetuator of some inequality and unjust systems. Some people said, you know, religion's just not for me, but I respect it and I have enjoyed getting to learn about it. And then some people said, you know, I go to church, but I don't really feel like I'm organizing from within the church. I feel like church is just something that I do, and then activism is also something that I do. So I think the real change here was that the church is not, you know, in the days of Martin Luther King out front, the people in the collars are not those who are sort of leading the charge, but rather the church is a little bit in the background, and it's in certain ways supporting young activists, and there are some young activists who find value in it, for sure. But it's interesting to see what a secular political activism movement will look like, and what that means for the strength of that movement and the longevity of it, and also the way that the politics of it differ and the ideology differs.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to me because I feel like a lot of I feel like in the United States we don't often have distinctly secular movements like this in this way. And also, I love the end of your article where you kind of laid out how, you know, religion is important for some people, it's not important for others, and, like, everyone just kind of continues on. And I wonder, if that'll force religious people to reframe or re-message a little bit, or think a little bit more deeply about what the role of religion is in their activism. I know that just in my own life, I've often been disappointed by the role of, like, my own Jewish community in certain activisms, and I wonder if like the next round of activism is really often very secular, maybe that'll challenge religious communities to articulate their vision of justice a little bit more forcefully or differently.
Yeah, I mean, I think that question is super fascinating, which is not just how is activism changing, but rather how is the church and religious institutions more broadly changing in response to activism?
Right.
And I think there are a lot of religious organizations that are going through moments of truth now. They've been going through these moments of truth probably for the last, you know, decade or so, but I think it really is starting to become really crisp, which is to say, a lot of institutions are looking around and saying, we see a lot of gray hair in our pews, or, you know, in our sanctuary, whatever it may be. We see that there's a lot going on in the world. There are a lot of social justice and sort of ministry-related issues that seem to be connected to our mission, but we're not really sure how to be part of that. We're not really sure what we've been doing wrong, such that people aren't really coming to us to try to mobilize this. And I think there are some churches in Baltimore, for example, that are trying to learn from young activists, and they are trying to sort of redo their book and redo their game plan. But I think, you know, to see what the different reactions will be about how institutions need to change is really, really fascinating. Even some conservative organizations are doing this, actually. The Southern Baptist Convention mm-hmm. has been going through this really interesting racial reconciliation process. And I think a lot of that comes from a newer wave of, you know, maybe Gen Y, Gen X leaders coming in and saying, okay, a lot of the standards that we've had around activism and engaging with things like police violence have just not been sufficient. What are we going to do to reinvent the way that we think about this?
Yeah, it does feel like we're at a bit of an inflection point for mm-hmm. where the role that millennials or younger people have within religious communities, not only in whether they're affiliating or not, but kind of the way they want to affiliate is starting to really have an impact on actually communities, as opposed to maybe gray-haired people in the pews just lamenting that there are no young people there, which yeah, there's absolutely. no shortage of articles that are making that point either.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's definitely true. I mean, you know, if you want to look at the most common theme in religion articles today, I'd say it's either the sky is falling about millennials,
yes.
sort of godless youths, or the sky is falling about religious institutions who don't have anybody going to them. So,
right.
you know, the sky is falling either way.
Right. As with all good articles about millennials have to somehow imply that millennials are ruining the world.
Can I weigh in as a millennial?
Yeah.
So as a millennial student activist, I suppose, I mean, this is bringing up like two different conversations for me, in that like I have had conversations with friends who have very much pushed off their religious institutions because they feel like they are preaching like separatism, that you are different than somebody else and that it doesn't accept like somebody and their differing views. But then in my own experience in college and being part of sort of more of a multi-faith community, I have found that my religion has been an entrance point into having a conversation with another student, and that we can share in each other's services and whatnot. And then when we agree on a certain like point of activism, that we can rally our own communities to come together. And that almost makes, I think, a stronger point in our cause, by this whole like coexist idea that we can all stand from our own different communities and our different heritages and be able to come together and stand on like a certain issue. And that's like become something that we speak about a lot, and saying like, I'm a Jew and I support my Muslim friends or something like that. We had a rally against Islamophobia that came from our Muslim Student Association, but there was a huge showing of Jewish students at that event, you know, wearing their yarmulkes and showing like, hey, this is our identity and we stand with our Muslim friends. And making that point, I think, is really, really makes an impact.
So, Emma, I want to transition to one last question, because you also write a lot about politics. And in this election cycle, it appears, at least to some of us on the outside of it, that religion and politics are kind of part of this election in ways that they haven't always been. I feel like there's been more overt hostility towards certain groups than maybe in previous election cycles. It feels like the conversation is a little bit more heated and tense. I'm curious if you think that that's true, or am I just reading particularly threatening news articles? And like, how are you reading it in the tea leaves as you kind of think about the campaign and cover the election?
Yeah. I mean, no doubt this election cycle has underlined, at least from my perspective, the importance of religion reporting and people who are religiously savvy, because conflicts of both religious freedom and then also sort of minority religious persecution have been centerpieces of both sides of the campaign, but particularly on the GOP side. So, you know, for example, unmistakably the rhetoric that has come from the Donald Trump campaign, a few of the other Republican nominees as well, about, for example, the way that Muslims should be treated, sort of suggestion that Muslims should be deported or that people who are Muslim refugees should be treated with sort of more suspicion or skepticism, I think is a chance, particularly for the media, to pause and really need to apply sort of pressure and a stress test to those claims that are being made. Because I think it creates fear. I think it creates an environment of questioning among some citizens. And I just think it's an opportunity to sort of stress test factual claims that are being made. But on the other side of it, and this story is maybe not as obvious or hasn't been as strong, but there have been so many legal and legislative religious freedom conflicts that have been happening as the presidential campaign has been going on. So, for example, we have just this past couple of weeks two bills that are specifically about religious freedom and sort of exemptions for people who don't want to serve at gay weddings for that kind of issue that have come up. And this has been a campaign platform for particularly GOP candidates on the other side, on the Democratic side. This has been sort of a point of opposition opposing these kinds of religious liberty bills.
Right.
There have been Supreme Court cases that are about, for example, exemptions to the Affordable Care Act for
Catholic
nuns.
Institutions.
And that is, all of that, I think, is shaping our political discourse right now and really gives this overall impression and, again, sort of underscores this idea that religion really is at the center of a lot of political discourse right now. And I don't know that it's necessarily more so than it has in the past, but it does feel really sharp this cycle. And I will be really interested to see how some of this develops, especially as we get down to a Democratic and Republican nominee.
Yeah, it's also, to me, it's even more interesting just because for at least, especially on the Democratic side, but even with Trump, none of the candidates besides Cruz don't really seem to be informed by religion in a very intense way. Like they don't see, it's like religion has come up more as an issue, but it's almost also that the candidates are less personally invested in some ways. I feel like that sometimes, I think those two actually go hand in hand. It's like harder to talk about well, and so blanket statements end up becoming a fallback.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think, in general, a thing to remember in politics is that every single statement is soundbite tested and polling tested, and so much of it is reductive that I think it's very easy to cross into the territory of sounding off a statement that sounds like bigotry or sort of making these blatant generalizations. And, different candidates say different things at different times depending on their audiences. And I think this is true of both Republicans and Democrats. So that's the other thing to remember, is that there's a lot of the rhetoric that is particularly can come with sort of identity politics or ethnic identity, or religious identity for that matter, that can really become simplistic and reductionist depending on what serves the needs of the candidate at any one time.
Great. So one last question and then we'll let you go. If you had to, thinking about the future and in the context of your reporting, is there a religious trend that we haven't touched on that you want to alert people to as particularly important, or something that's going to be, you think is going to, in the next 5 years, we're going to start reading a lot more about, and something that maybe when you started doing a lot of reporting on religion, you weren't necessarily as attuned to, but now you're thinking, oh, this is actually really important?
I would say a couple of things. The first is, I think the conflict over gender and sexuality and the way that that relates to religious groups is not going to end. I think that the thing of what will probably be several years of that kind of conflict, and I think not necessarily more importantly, but perhaps more complexly, religious communities are going to have to grapple with these questions for a long, long time. So I think sexuality and gender and the way that relates to religion is huge. And I think the other thing is just the changing power bases of what religious groups are influential, both culturally and politically. So this is everything from being a big voting block. Like, for example, you know, the putative evangelical voting block, which was never actually so simple as it was described. Right. You know, that I think is shifting and has shifted, and we'll see a lot of difference in voting patterns with that over time. But it's also about, you know, the mores that people embrace. And I think that is not shifting, again, in a unidirectional fashion. I don't think it's that, you know, America is becoming loose and godless and nobody cares about, you know, sort of ethical conduct or anything like that. I think it's that there's a lot more complexity and difference. There's a lot more fracture in American society. And it's, you know, going to be an interesting set of questions about pluralism, which is different groups becoming sort of more intense, smaller, and also having to live in tension and in conflict and maybe in peace with other groups that have different views than they do.
I think that's a great note for us to end on, because that's when I'm kind of teaching about this at NYU, one of the main data points that I also point people to is just that we're becoming often less rigidly religiously identified and more religiously diverse at the same time. And those two together will make some sort of religious pluralism in the future look very different, and also make it especially, you know, much more important for us as a country.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you, Madeline. Thank you, Emma, for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
We'll have to have you back again at another point after your next big religion reporting project.
Yeah, that would be very fun.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks.
Nice to meet you, Madeline.
Nice to meet you, too.
Listening to another episode of Multifaithful. Especially like to thank our guests, Emma Green, and our student, the wonderful Madeline Dolgen, for joining on the interview. Also thank you, as always, to Brian Young for editing and producing the podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please be in touch at spiritual.life@nyu.edu. Please rate and review us on iTunes before having you back listening to another episode next week.